This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. It's time for Trumpet Hour, looking back at the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
This past Monday, 25 European Union nations officially launched a EU military pact. Europe is starting to get down to the nuts and bolts of how to fight together effectively as a single European army. This is a story with huge prophetic implications, something we've been watching closely for decades. To learn more about it, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yeah, so we touched on this story back when they first agreed to this partnership. That was back in November. So if you remember, this was what was called permanent structured cooperation. Back then, a group of 22 nations back then agreed that they were going to work together more closely on the military. Since then, a few more have signed up. So now we have 25. And on Monday, they kind of signed some more of the final paperwork to put this all into action. More of this final paperwork was signed yesterday. So now this is a done deal. It's not just something that they're announcing. It started. And with that beginning, we also got a look at what this deal will mean, what some of these projects were. So what we knew about, just to recap, was we knew that this agreement would really prod EU nations to spend more on their military. So they can only be part of this military cooperation and have access to certain EU funds to spend on their military if they keep increasing their military spending, if they keep up with military targets, if they devote a certain percentage of their military to EU figures. So that's going to continue. And then on Monday, they unveiled the 17 or so projects that they're going to be working on. And, you know, I think the thing with this agreement is it seems like everything about it is almost designed to be boring. So it's called PESCO, which, you know, kind of sounds like something you put on pasta, not our great new EU military initiative.
Right. And yeah, it's permanent structured cooperation. That doesn't sound particularly daunting as well.
Exactly. But then when you look at what these are the nuts and bolts of really making these countries work together. It's a start. It's not a finish, but it's a fantastic start for these nations working together. Because if you're going to have 20-odd nations' militaries cooperating, you need to have certain things in place. So you need to work out, okay, well, if we're all going to work together, how do we work together to evacuate the wounded from the battlefield? Is it going to be every man for himself, or is there going to be some kind of overall coordination between the different countries? How do we transport our troops there? Again, if we just rely on each nation to get their soldiers there, well, that's going to take much longer. It's going to be a bit of a mess. So what can we do to work together so that we can move all of our forces to the battlefield as quickly as possible? What about different command structures? You know, training people to work together so that if a German general wants to work with a French general, you know, what's the best way to do that? How can the German general give orders or instructions to people lower down in the French chain of command in such a way that's not going to be confusing? So it's all these kind of boring details, but what they add up to is something very significant. There was a former Marine Corps general, for example, who said, you know, amateurs talk tactics, but the professionals study logistics. And these kind of boring details like logistics, I mean, you look at the great generals of the past, and logistics has been a huge part of their success. I mean, fine, they've still got to win the battle, and that I don't want to downplay that. But at the same time, a good chunk of winning the battle is getting the right men and the right soldiers at the right place at the right time. It's the ability to be able to move around countries very quickly. And that's what Europe's working together. So it might not have, say, the big fanfare of an EU army, but this is really practical stuff. And it's things that is going to make a big difference in Europe's military power overall.
What you said about just the fact that it's not, it's very boring that they're finding ways to get all of these logistics in place without it making a lot of headlines. This is a type of thing that a lot of media outlets looking at, they just wouldn't find a whole lot to be concerned about. This wouldn't be of much interest to them. I'm just reminded of that recent Key of David program that Gerald Fleury did about the world's hidden superpower, or this, the fact that they do so much, Europe does so much in exactly this way. And when you look at the language that Bible prophecy uses about this empire, it talks about underground, it talks about basically this bursting on the scene, and it kind of shocks the whole world because the world hasn't been alert to the way that this has been building.
Exactly. And it's because of scriptures like this that we have been watching closely, that we have been trying to pay attention to every little detail. I mean, remember, another initiative that we've talked about for a long time is the way Germany's been incorporating other armies into their army. They've been swallowing up just about 2/3 of the Dutch army, roughly, now it's directly under German command and basically in their army. And you see almost nothing about that in the Western press. And part of that, I think, is just the way the Western press are asleep. But part of that is exactly that, what you said there. And that philosophy just infuses everything that they do. And it is all done very quietly. It's not too hard to dig into these things, but it's still it's not done with great fanfare at all.
This was one of the biggest things that Herbert W. Armstrong warned about for years. Can you just give us bring us up to speed with why we are watching this, why this is so important to us, how integral this has been to the trumpet's message, the plain truth before us, and why the prophecies that have underpinned this forecast?
Well, you alluded to Revelation 17, where you quoted or talked about the way the Bible talks about this power being underground. Over there, it talks about this power. It says that it is, and it was, and it is not. You know, it's kind of hiding and emerging. And that same chapter in Revelation 17, well, it makes clear that this coming power in Europe is a union of 10 kings, it says here. So as soon as you had a union in, Mr. Armstrong was saying, watch for this in Europe, watch for a union of 10 kings to come under a major king. And then as soon as you had 1957, 1958, the very initial beginnings of the European Union, back then it was the European Economic Community, come together, and right away Mr. Armstrong and the Plain Truth are saying, look, this is going to be that power. This is exactly what we've been warning about even decades before then, that there's going to be this union of 10 nations. And now you're starting to see a union. And back then, Mr. Armstrong was saying, well, watch for them to have a common government. Watch for a common currency. Watch, it's going to grow out of a trade initiative. We see they've got the common currency now. And he said, well, they're going to have a common military. And you can see that again in Revelation 17. It talks about these 10 different kings giving their strength and power to this overall organization. And that's exactly, that's a very specific prophecy right there, of these nations coming together in a military fashion. And then there's many other prophecies of that, directly or indirectly. We talk about, for example, Daniel 11 comes up a lot on this program, where we talk about the clash between Europe and the Middle East. And in that chapter, it talks about Europe being a major military power, which implies things like working together, getting these things worked out. It talks about the nation moving like a whirlwind, or the power moving like a whirlwind, being prepared, forward deployed with bases, and being able to move very quickly. So there's a lot of scriptures that you put these all together and you see this is going to be a military power. They're going to work well together. They're going to be able to have a very high capacity. So that's why we've been warning about that for decades. And as you said, that's one of our key warnings. It's one of our trends articles that you can get up there on the top right of our site, the trends section. And we'll also make sure we include a link in the show notes. But we have a trend there, watching Europe militarizing, why the trumpet watches Europe's push towards a unified military.
Yeah, that's an excellent resource to point people to. That trends article really gives an excellent background of what's been happening, why we've been watching this, and what we've been watching, and those prophecies that you just mentioned, giving more background, more detail about those. For anyone who's interested, go check that out, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military. We appreciate that, Richard. How dangerous is Iran, the biblically prophesied king of the South? The American ambassador to the United Nations made a presentation yesterday giving some hard evidence of what the Islamic Republic is up to. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this was highly unusual for the United States to do such a thing. This was where United Nations ambassador for the United States, Nikki Haley, was at a warehouse military base in Washington, D.C., and in front of her reporters, she was at a podium. Behind her was just this massive ballistic missile, a used ballistic missile. This, in fact, was the one that was fired by the Houthis, the Iranian-backed group that operates out of Yemen towards the Saudi capital that there's conflicting reports whether it was blown out of the sky or landed close to the airport in Riyadh. And so that was transported to the United States, the casing, and it was on display through in front of all the reporters so that Nikki Haley could talk about what Iran is doing, breaking several United Nations Security Council resolutions by using these ballistic missiles, by giving them or transporting them into the hands of another military group or even just transporting them. Apparently that's illegal for them to do. And so she wanted to show the proof. And she even said, quote, "As you know, we do not often declassify this type of military equipment recovered from these attacks, but today we are taking an extraordinary step of presenting it here in an open setting. We did this for a single urgent purpose because the Iranian regime cannot be allowed to engage in its lawless behavior any longer." So there it was, right in front of everyone, this massive ballistic missile.
Yeah, the United States basically saying, let's stop pretending like Iran is complying with all of the requirements. It's violating several international agreements that would prevent this type of behavior. The Saudis obviously cooperating with this in an attempt to expose Iran's activities. And how does Iran respond to this? This is seems like incontrovertible proof.
Right. So Iran, they're kind of smart with the way that they respond. They basically said, the foreign minister came out and said, "I've seen this kind of evidence before." And I think he tweeted a picture of Colin Powell, the former U.S. Secretary of State, before the United States invaded Iraq back in 2003, saying that they have all this evidence of weapons of mass destruction. So he's basically saying this is not true. Fake news. That's not our missile. It didn't come from us, just like there was no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So they kind of are blowing this off. And it doesn't look like others are blowing it off. There is quite a lot of proof out there that I think every nation apart from Iran knows that Iran is shipping, is having shipments of these type of weapons, especially to the Houthis in Yemen, of course, across into Syria. And even the Europeans came out on Wednesday with a joint statement, which is kind of rare, a joint statement that actually it didn't necessarily have teeth to it, but it did talk about what Iran was doing with its ballistic missile program. It says basically that they are breaking, well, it looks like they're breaking these agreements and Iran basically needs to stop it. And then a day later, we had proof of that in Washington, D.C. with this ballistic missile on display.
I think it's interesting that the United States is making these kinds of declarations, bringing this information out into the open and basically challenging the world to say, look, are you willing to look at the evidence or not? And yet knowing what we know prophetically, it's not going to be the United States that checks Iran. You do just wonder how much of what the United States is doing here is kind of pushing Europe to step up and do something about this. It seems like there's so much regarding the international community's dealings with Iran that is kind of in this like fantasy land realm, and the United States is kind of helping to dispel some of that fantasy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we could have had this 6-7 years ago because we had the Israeli leadership doing it. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's been doing this for a decade, trying to expose what Iran's doing. And yet the United States at the time under President Obama didn't follow on with that or back him up. And now it looks like the United States has taken the mantle under Mr. Trump at exposing the Iranian regime, forcing other nations to decide whether they agree with the United States or not, and presenting this incontrovertible proof. And I think what it is happening, at least as far as Bible prophecy goes, as you said, it is presenting these facts to the Europeans. And the Europeans, it looks like they're slow at doing everything, but it looks like they're coming together with some type of unified response that does say Iran, enough is enough with some of these activities. How strong they get with that, we'll see. But there has been a change, I believe, over the past couple of weeks as far as European awareness to what Iran is doing, and that should be based purely from, or is caused purely by, Mr. Trump, the Saudis, and the Israeli leadership exposing what Iran's doing.
For more information, where would you send people?
For more information on this, you can go to our Trends article. It's entitled, at least to see how Europe responds to it, the Trends article, Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Russia has had quite a successful military run in Syria, and it is now securing a presence there that could be very advantageous going forward. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin submitted an agreement to the Russia State Duma on Wednesday, and it calls for Moscow to create a full-fledged naval base in Syria's Mediterranean coastal city of Tartus. The former head of the Russian Navy's mainstay, a man named Admiral Viktor Kravchenko, has emerged as kind of the spokesman for this project. And on Wednesday, he told Interfax that the move will strengthen the operational capabilities of Russia's fleet in the Mediterranean and, in general, Russia's position in the Middle East.
So how important is this for Russia? How will it strengthen its position within the Middle East?
Well, since the Soviet era, Russia has maintained a logistics hub in Tartus. This hub was founded all the way back in the early 70s, and the Russians have maintained really a presence there since then, but it's never been a full-fledged naval base. It's only been a logistics hub with considerable limitations. And then with the hub as it currently is, the Tartus Channel is not deep or wide enough for first-rank ships to really come all the way to the harbor, so they have to remain in the outer roads and be refueled and serviced with the assistance of auxiliary fleet vessels. But this new plan calls for the channel to be deepened and widened enough to accommodate all of those large ships, even including cruisers of the first rank. And it calls for two new piers to be added that can moor vessels with a displacement of over 10,000 tons. And it's a really significant expansion of this logistics hub. And I think that it will boost Russia's ability to just project power into not only the Middle East, but also the Mediterranean Sea.
So on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this week, Stephen Fleury was talking about Vladimir Putin visiting Syria this week, kind of taking his victory lap. The Russian engagement in Syria, it seems we've talked about just the fact that it's been targeted, it's been limited, and it's been extremely successful. The fact that it's able to establish this base there definitely seems to underline the fact that Russia has accomplished quite a lot with not a whole lot of outlay of effort.
Yes, yeah, it really seems like they were able to turn the tides in the Syrian conflict to their advantage, to the advantage of the Assad regime. And it seems like they were able to accomplish all that, as you said, without having to expend a lot of treasure and blood.
This is something that European leaders would certainly be keenly watching.
That's right. Yeah, the Mediterranean is viewed as Europe's backyard, so it's got to be really alarming for the Europeans, and especially when this is placed alongside Russia's growing influence in the Middle East in general, and its increasing focus on military preparedness and its expansionism into Ukraine and Georgia, which we've seen in recent years. When you put all this together, that gives the Europeans quite a lot to be alarmed about.
So put this in prophetic context for us.
Sure. Chapter 50 in the book of Jeremiah talks about a major battle that will happen in the end time. And it says in verse 1 that a unified European power, which Richard was just talking quite a lot about in his first segment there, in this passage, that European power is referred to as Babylon. And it says that it will be confronted by a massive Asian army. And the Bible shows that this Asian army will be led by Russia. So we know that this war is coming very soon, and that's why it's prophetically significant today when we see Russia just ramping up its military presence in Syria and in the Mediterranean, and to know that the Europeans would be very frightened by that. And we have a book that we send out for free. It's called Russia and China in Prophecy. And this book thoroughly explains those passages in Jeremiah 50 and numerous other Bible passages about Russia and China. And we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes for any listeners who would like to understand more about that. So please just go to thetrumpet.com and check out Russia and China in Prophecy.
Richard, you had a comment?
Yeah, well, just to back up what Jeremiah was saying about Europe being concerned, it just came up even yesterday. EU members, when the EU heads of state were signing the agreement on military cooperation, they also agreed to extend sanctions on Russia. And just about every article and a lot of even the speeches that European leaders have given, people like Donald Tusk, when they're talking about this EU military, they are talking about Russia. Mm-hmm. So if you look at what they've talked about in this context, that's absolutely about the number one thing up there with the Middle East in terms of what is pushing this. So you can definitely see that this is one of the biggest factors in pushing Europe along here.
Yeah, exactly what you just said. This is something that Gerald Fleury has been talking about since 2004, that article when Vladimir Putin, I think it was his second election that he won and consolidated power in a way that really gave the world an indication of just how dictatorial his regime was going to be. And Gerald Fleury immediately pointed to how much that was going to affect Europe, how much Europe was rattled to see that kind of power taking hold on its eastern border. And wow, we have really seen that that pronouncement back in 2004 backed up by subsequent events and exactly this type of thing that we're seeing here in Syria. This is definitely something that is of major concern to European powers. Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Let's talk about politics in the United States. It's as ugly as it gets right now with allegations of scandals, the FBI probing the last election, that group being discredited as being extremely partisan. Now the investigators are being investigated. People are wanting to scrap the whole process and start over. This is quite a soap opera for the whole world to see. To learn more about it, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right, yeah. Politics within the United States is not something we actually talk about on this this program segment a lot compared to other news stories, just because oftentimes it is more political theater than it is geopolitically significant news. But yet there are some weeks, and this being one of them, that the political theater just gets so ridiculous that it actually, the theater itself becomes biblically significant.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those weeks to where obviously the big revelation was that one of the top FBI officials assigned to Robert Mueller's Russia collusion investigation was removed, fired last summer over some politically charged text he'd sent disparaging President Trump and supporting Hillary Clinton, showing that he wasn't as unbiased as they said he is when they put him on this special counsel. But to just put this back in context, just because these probes, it's only been out here for 7 months, but it quickly gets confusing, is that this started back in June 2016. Somebody hacked the Democratic National Convention. CIA said it was likely Russia, and so when President Trump won the election, many of his political opponents said it was like, well, the only possible way he could have won that election is if he like subversively cooperated with Russia to influence public opinion. And there wasn't really any proof of that, but the allegations got so loud that they hired former FBI Director Robert Mueller to look into it. And it was May 23rd he was deemed by Congress to be an unbiased person to be able to oversee this without and just get justice done without favoring any political agenda. Didn't have a lot of success finding stuff until just recently when former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was revealed to have met with a Russian official, which wasn't illegal, but he lied about it. So that's the, I guess that's the only like notch on the bedpost Robert Mueller would have been able to rack up as this one NSA director. Mm-hmm. But now you're coming to like this week where this is getting big, where it's, they've had a couple reports out. One came out that they examined the political contributions of people within the Justice Department and found that 95% of political contributions from that department went to the Clinton campaign, mm-hmm. just showing how partisan the department itself is in this. And now, in addition to this man who was just fired this summer, they found out at least 50% of Mueller's unbiased team has been shown to have been avid Democratic Clinton supporters in the last election. Mm-hmm. And so this just more and more and more, you just keep getting revelations that this isn't actually this unbiased legal system, but it's almost more like something you'd see in like a Latin American nation where one political party gets into power and prosecutes the other party, and then it flips forward and instead of there being any semblance of the rule of law, the government's more just like rival gangs who hate each other more than even they're concerned about foreign nations.
Right. I think that's a good way of looking at it. You just look at how this is unfolding, and it shows a level of division within Washington and within the country. I mean, if you look at the polls, it seems like Americans generally, if you're Republican, you pretty much believe that the president and his administration are clean. If you're Democrat, you pretty much believe that they're dirty. That all of this, the look into all of these allegations, that it needs to continue. But this doesn't make the Justice Department look good. It doesn't make this whole probe. It kind of throws the whole thing into suspicion. And the fact that all of this is playing out before the entire world, basically watching Washington tear itself apart, that has to have pretty major ramifications for America's ability to conduct its business around the world.
Right. Yeah. Just this level of like bickering and just airing your dirty laundry, I guess, before the world. It is something that you'd normally associate with a banana republic or a Latin American dictatorship or some of the big men of Africa with their rival groups and rival militias. But for a developed nation, I mean, it is kind of, America's almost become like a proverb and a byword around the world, is that, I mean, you see in Europe, there's political division there, but unless it's not just not getting the news coverage, you don't see anything about this kind of level of like corruption and just prosecuting back and forth coming to that, which really does it just ties into like the decline of American leadership, just like the quality of leadership here in the country.
Right. Yeah. Just looking at this prophetically, what prophecies jump out at you?
Right. Cause I was reading just last night after I'd read through these news stories about this, there's a few verses here in Isaiah 3 that just really paints like this dystopian vision that's sounding kind of like chillingly familiar, where it says, "For behold, the Lord does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the staff and the stay and the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water, the mighty man and the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator. I will give children to be their princes, and babes will rule over them. All the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. when a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, you have clothing, be our ruler, and let all this ruin be under your hand. And then that day he will say, saying, I will not be a healer, for in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler of this people, for Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen. And so it's kind of a progression, is that America's not quite to the point yet where there's no bread and no clothes and Jerusalem's fallen. But the eloquent orator and the cunning artificer and everything else has happened. So it does show just where that lack of leadership and just corruption and even like every man oppressing each other. It's not even party against party, but it's almost gets to the point eventually, which is like person against person.
Yep. Well, very interesting. If people wanted more information about that, do we have some articles or resources that you would point people to?
Actually, I'd probably go with the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet. It's an in-depth analysis into the entire book of Isaiah, but it, obviously I think it has
it's quite a few
almost
passages
a whole chapter on Isaiah 3 in particular, because it has, as you go through that chapter, it has more information about family decline and things like that, which mm-hmm. show why the leadership decline happened in the first place and what you could do to reverse it in your own life.
Well, thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about evidence that Hamas may not be growing as moderate as some people seem to have hoped, one of the biggest trade deals in the world about to be signed, and one world leader saying that 2017 has been a crossroads of history in the global power balance. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This week, the Arab terrorist group Hamas celebrated its 30th anniversary, and its leader went on the record with his thoughts about Donald Trump's recent announcement that the U.S. recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital. If you were hopeful that Hamas was becoming more moderate, this might dash those hopes. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this took place on Thursday in the Gaza Strip. This was a huge rally, again, 30th anniversary of Hamas, before tens of thousands of people. Their leader, Ismail Haniyeh, really did decry the announcement by Mr. Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and definitely declared that Hamas is going to fight this decision quite a lot, as much as they can. He said this, I'll just give you a couple of quotes from that speech. He said, there is no such thing as the state of Israel, so it cannot have a capital called Jerusalem. And then he said, we will work on forcing the American administration to reverse its unjust decision. Our goal is to break the American position. We will bring down the Trump decision once and for all. And then he actually went on to declare a day of rage. This is what whenever Israel or the United States does something that they do not like, Hamas and other Palestinian factions declare a day of rage. This is meant to be a day of protest, a day of violent protest across Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and any other place. Now, and we've even seen that they declared one of those for last Friday. Well, now he said every single Friday from now on, until Mr. Trump reverses this decision, is going to be a Hamas-led day of rage.
Lots of process there. First of all, there is no such thing as the state of Israel. That's quite a statement. I just can't help but think it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about Hamas removing elements of its charter that seemed to soften its approach toward the Jewish state. And we were talking about this reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah and the fact that Hamas would be integrated into the political Palestinian politics. What about that? That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't that long ago. I think something we've seen since that time, I mean, I don't know if this is a complete change of course. Hamas kind of leopard change its spots. I mean, it's always right. been this way. We even spoke about how that this reconciliation deal was a bid to gain power in the event that they could control the entire Palestinian people and then be use that as the platform to wage war against Israel, or even in a way to present itself, if it works at the time, as a more as an alternative to Fatah as far as negotiating peace. Mm-hmm. Now, that does look like that's out the door, mm-hmm. that idea that they were going to be a more middle of the road, or at least somebody that Israel could work with. Mm-hmm. That might have been because Iran has really stepped up its sponsorship of Hamas in the past 6 months quite a lot. Even it looks like some of these statements might have even been infused with by Iranian leadership. They might have inspired some of these comments from Hamas.
And well, so that is an important thing to consider. It was just on Wednesday's program that we were talking about this, just the fact that what happened, what Donald Trump did, that this we expected this to have a more immediate impact on the part of the Arabs there in the in Israel itself, in the West Bank. But Iran really has shown itself to be the main factor that Israel needs to be concerned about. And maybe this really does give us an indication of just how accurate that assessment is.
It certainly does. Just this on Monday or Tuesday, there was a phone call between the Iranian's Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force leader, Qassem Soleimani, the general that really does appear in Syria, Iraq, wherever Iran is focusing or has its most pressing objective. You have this general showing up to direct things. And he himself made a phone call to Haniyeh earlier this week before that speech on Thursday, and he basically pledged support for Hamas in their actions against the Americans. And according to that phone call, he said that other forces in the region are now ready also to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Then he said he pledged the support to Hamas and the Islamic Jihad for the resistance against Israel. So this was a direct phone call from Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian general, to Hamas. The same week, the Hamas leader comes out and says, we're going to fight this until Mr. Trump backs down. And we're going to have, again, this day of rage every Friday until that happens. So it definitely looks like Iran's behind this increasing rhetoric of Hamas.
So just to remind our listeners about why this is important prophetically and where they might go for more information if they're interested.
Right. So this is coming into focus more and more now, Iran's goal of capturing Jerusalem, using any proxy, Hezbollah, Hamas, it can to do that. And we base this prophecy, this forecast that we know that they want to do this off different prophecies in the Bible that talked about this. But the articles you can go to read about this, there's one called The Precious Jewel of Iran's Plan, written back in 2005. And yet it documents how serious Iran is of this goal. That's why it's supporting Hamas so strongly, because it does desire to use it to its own strategic ends in Jerusalem.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Brent. One of the biggest trade deals in the world has been in the works for years, and it looks like it's about to be signed. It's being negotiated by the European Union and some countries in South America. It's a deal with major economic implications for America and the world, and major prophetic implications as well. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, for at least 7 years, there's been this deal in negotiation between the Mercosur trade bloc in South America and the European Union. I actually remember even writing about this 7 years ago for updates on thetrumpet.com, which I believe are still up there if anyone's inclined to dig for them. I don't. A lot's changed since then, because this is a huge deal. It's thought to be going to be about $100 billion trade deal, basically mashing together Europe and Latin America. Both sides have wanted it in theory for years. It normally gets caught up. The negotiations get hung up over like agriculture exports. The European Union is very famous for giving government subsidies to farmers. And so South America has been concerned that if these farmers can export food there, then they can export food cheap. They can make food with government subsidies cheaper than the Latin American farmers, mm-hmm. and that will throw their trade balance off. But now, according to the EU trade commissioner, especially in light of some of the deteriorating relations between Latin America and the Trump administration, Europe wants to hit with the iron's hot. They've gotten a panel of 12 people in a room, and they're like, we want this done by December 31st this year.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 weeks from now, if they can hold to their self-imposed deadline. They want this trade deal done, mashing together Europe and most of Latin America into this huge $100 billion trade bloc.
So you mentioned that we've had articles, including yours from 7 years ago, but we've written quite a lot about anticipating this kind of a deal being done, starting with an economic deal, but even going beyond that at some point. But economics may be forming the foundation of a relationship between Europe and Latin America. Put it in prophetic context for us, why this is so important that we watch this.
Yeah, I'll actually have something here I can read. This is from chapter 7 of our editor-in-chief, Gerald Roy's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision.
This is your go-to book today.
Isaiah's in the news this week. But this is chapter 7. It's called Building Towards a World Catastrophe, where it writes, it says, Herbert Armstrong long prophesied, and we expect, the alliance between Europe and South America to grow extremely strong. The most significant factors that will cement this connection are language and religion. Roman Catholicism is the dominant religion of Latin America, and next to English, Spanish is the second most spoken language in the world. But it will not be a union of equals. The Latin American countries will be vassal states to Europe.
Mm.
And so this is a book that's been out for a number of years and quoting articles from Herbert W. Armstrong that have been out for a number of decades.
Yep.
Just pointing to this, that they really expect that this relationship between Europe and Latin America to grow strong. And that's based on prophecies and, for one, in Revelation 17 about this this great church that rules over nations.
This empire, this economic empire that we're going to see in Europe, obviously there's the church associated with it, but it is amazing when you look at those prophecies regarding that empire, just how much economics is kind of at the center of a lot of what they're doing, at least their activity globally.
Right, and that's why that paragraph is in our Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, is in particular that seventh chapter goes in a lot through Isaiah 23,
mm-hmm.
where it talks about, actually the chapter's about the destruction of the Holy Roman Empire, but by the way of talking about that destruction, it gives out a great, big, long list of nations that were included in its trading empire. And when you study the modern identity of those nations, I mean, it includes Europe and it includes China and it includes Russia and it includes Japan. And it doesn't necessarily single out Latin and America in particular, but like I said, based on the religious connection and the language connection and other prophecies about this Holy Roman Empire waging an economic siege against America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It really makes sense that if you're just thinking about it, when Nebuchadnezzar sieged Jerusalem, it's more simple
mm-hmm.
to seize a city. You just need an army. But if you're going to lay siege against a continent
surrounded by oceans,
I mean, you need a lot of economic heft to mm-hmm. pull that off.
Right.
I don't think there's anything quite been done like it in world history. And that chapter really puts it, so it says Europe's really going to need Latin America if they're going to be able to pull off a siege on a global scale like the Bible prophesies it will.
Yeah, that's outstanding. Very, very good. Very important to watch that. Check out Isaiah's End Time Vision. You can find that under the literature tab on thetrumpet.com that talks more about that economic empire in the making. And we'll put some other links under the on the show notes for this program if you want to learn more about that. We appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Germany is making some inroads into Northern Africa. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, we had a couple of significant pieces of news on this week. So the German president went to Ghana. So he was drumming up business relationships. That was Frank-Walter Steinmeier and meeting with politicians there. And this is part of Germany's compact with Africa. Germany's leading the G20 right now, and it's really trying to use that to push for much deeper economic cooperation with African nations. So they're trying to help develop Ghana, give them some money for development, that kind of thing. There's about 10 nations participating in that. And then the day before, Angela Merkel was at a different conference, this conference with what was in France, with what's called the G5 countries. These countries are in the Sahel region, the sub-Saharan African region of Africa, Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and Chad. And these nations are putting together a counter-terrorism force, so a multinational force to combat terrorism in the area. It's being funded by Europe. Angela Merkel announced that Germany was ready to provide €1 billion over the next 4 years for this force. France has also pledged a decent amount of money in the past. America's pledged €60 million. And then these African nations have pledged €10 million each. But then also Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. At that meeting on Wednesday, they announced that they were going to put in $130 million to help create this regional military force. So, why are we talking about Africa here? And this is just a really direct fulfillment of something we've been watching for in this region. It was, I think, about 3-4 years ago, Mr. Gerard Fleury had an article called Watch Algeria. And right at the start of that article, he says, watch Africa. Africa is going to be building into this this battleground between Europe and radical Islam that has enormous strategic implications. And then just since then, look at what we've seen. We've seen massive French and German deployments into Mali, and Germany then really taking the lead in this Malian deployment with hundreds of troops there, German soldiers talking about building Mali up as a base where they can project power into Libya and other African countries. You've seen the French with a major military deployment in the Central African Republic. And now you see them working together with other Arab nations, which is kind of a separate thing. We've also talked about Europe working with these Arab nations, and they're working together to build up this military force in this North African region. So you're really seeing Europe getting much more involved in this region, exactly as Mr. Fleury said they had. And there's just been so many developments since he wrote that. So that's a great article to read, Watch Algeria, just to see that analysis. He goes through in that article the Bible prophecies behind that. This is part of that clash that's building between the King of the North and the King of the South. But several dramatic fulfillments of that just even in the last week.
That's outstanding. Just thinking about the stories that we've had on today's Trumpet Hour about Europe, it's interesting. These are not headlines that you're seeing in too many news sources out there, but this development of a European military, the establishment of a trade bloc between Europe and Latin America, Europe in incursions into North Africa and building alliances with Arab states in the Middle East, all of these really are significant prophetically, and yet stories that are going to be, they're not really going to hit the radar screen on most news watchers out there. But when you have that orientation of what is it that biblical prophecy says truly is significant, it helps you to see these things in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. We appreciate that, Richard. We're going to conclude the program now with, well, a bit of a big picture view from a high-ranking Chinese official. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi issued an end-of-year assessment on December 10th, and he said that as 2017 is coming to a close, it's easy to see that the world is now at a crucial stage of evolving international landscape and shifting balance of power. And he said the world is changing like never before, and China is on the final leg of its march toward national rejuvenation. In a great era that's unfolding before our eyes, let us follow the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee with Comrade Xi Jinping at its core. And so this was part of a very lengthy speech that Mr. Wang delivered at the, it was the opening of the Symposium on International Developments and Diplomacy. And in the speech, Mr. Wang really just painted a revealing picture of the way China sees its place in the world at an official government level, and the way the nation believes that the U.S. era is rapidly ending and leaving a massive opening in global leadership for China to fill.
So this is obviously something that we talk about quite a lot. To hear this coming from the mouth of a Chinese official is somewhat chilling. It's hard to dismiss what he said.
Yes, that's right. And he also spent quite a lot of time commending China's great achievements during 2017. And he said that going forward, Beijing aims to take on a much greater role on the international stage. His phrasing here was pretty interesting. He said China will, quote, play a bigger and more constructive role in upholding world stability. And he said that Beijing will find ways of, quote, resolving hotspot issues around the world using Chinese characteristics. And he specifically mentioned the Syria crisis, the Afghanistan situation, the North Korea crisis, and even said that China will try to help resolve the Israel-Palestine dispute. So he says China is ready to mediate and broker and negotiate and stabilize any place where there are tensions.
So the end of the American era, these countries, China being one of the major ones, stepping up to fill that void. This is right out of the pages of Bible prophecy.
Yes, yeah, that's right. The Bible talks about a time in the end, an end time era that's called in Scripture the times of the Gentiles. And Jesus Christ himself used this term in Luke 21 verse 24, and the context is that these times will occur after a shift in global power takes place, pushing power away from America and Britain, really, and toward two main power blocks, one led by Germany and the other one led by Russia and China. So this was, for this prophesied time to occur, there has to be a shift of power to China. So Mr. Wang is really right about the shift that is beginning, and it is leading to these biblically prophesied times of the Gentiles.
All right, outstanding. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Do visit the Trumpet Hour on thetrumpet.com. We have a hub there for this radio program, this podcast. We will include links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's been a pleasure
to be here. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Martin Tupper. Memory is not wisdom. Idiots can repeat by rote volumes. Let me try that again. Memory is not wisdom. Idiots can by rote repeat volumes. Yet, what is wisdom without memory? Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.